This is the place to get hugs. I live alone, and so I'm really just taking all the hugs I can get today. As you already know, my name is Dee, thank you, Dee Smith, and I am Dee Smith. No, I'm D.S. Okay. So what I'd like to do is share with you some of the things that I've observed in my living to age 72. I never thought in the world that I could ever be 72. I thought I'd always be around 25. But that isn't what happened. Did anybody else have that feeling? You did. Yeah, no, that didn't happen that way. So anyway, in April I got to be 72, and I feel real good, and I'm pretty happy, and I think the world is pretty nice, and everything is quite positive. But what I have to do now is go back into my more negative times and share with you what brought me to this point in the program. I was born into a family of a mother and a father and a brother. The brother was 5 years old at the time I was born, and I often felt through my childhood that the family was complete at that point. And so I evidently was a mistake, and I went into this family. And in looking back to that period of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, I remember very little. I remember my mother as being gone most of the time. My mother was a bridge player. And when anybody asked me, would I like to play bridge? No, I wouldn't. Because she was gone most of the time playing bridge. So my father, I see, as being there and caring about me, but caring more for my mother. And my mother and my brother were very close. So that left me kind of in the open, and I began to do things on my own. They weren't very good, but I began to do them. Do you hear me well? The first thing that happened was my mother took me to a luncheon with her, and that was rare. And I remember that. And I remember the table was beautifully decorated in her friend's home. And the people were all sitting around, and there were flowers on the table. I must have been around 4. And I can see that scene in my mind. And as soon as I had eaten the dessert, which was blueberry pie, I vomited on the table. And knowing a little more today about psychology and so forth, I think it was deliberate. But I don't remember ever, ever going out again with my mother. So, when my mother died at age 68, I felt very, very sad because I felt that I had never known her. And today, I still have no feeling of having known my mother. So you might say I grew up without a mother. My father did many things for me. But if my mother was 10 years younger than he, for one thing. If she wanted anything, then he would drop whatever he was doing with me and off he'd go. The only thing I remember my brother did with me was let me stand on his shoes, and he would dance me around the floor. These aren't very good memories, are they? But I'm telling you this because I want you to know what kind of a person I was when I went to marriage finally. I was a self-centered person. I was independent. Don't do it for me. I'll do it myself. Don't put your arms on me. You notice I like the hugging, but don't touch me, I said then. So I went through school, and when I went into the first grade, I wrote a love letter to a boy in the 8th grade and explained to him how I felt about him. And it was intercepted by one of the nuns. Today, that wouldn't have been so bad, would it? But 50, 60 years ago, that was pretty bad. So, my mother was called. And I remember my mother going to see the nuns, and she said, I'll take care of it. So very shortly after that, I started skipping school. First grader. And I started skipping school, and I would go home. And my mother would say, why are you here? And I'd say, I don't feel well. And she said, then you can have some castor oil. And she gave it to me. And every time it'd go down, it'd come up, and she'd give me some more. That was my punishment for coming home from school. And I would always, if I kept it down, I'd always get some orange juice. And to this day, I don't care for orange juice. It reminds me of the castor oil. So I went on and went through school and finally graduated from high school very much the same person. I left school frequently in my senior year. I walked around and had a good time. I went to some movies and did all kinds of things like that. And nobody ever stopped me. So I kept right on going. By the time I was ready to graduate from high school, I had decided that I would become a nurse. And it was during the Depression. And there was no money. So I said, okay, I'll work. So for the summer I worked, took care of a little boy, 2 years old, and I got $2 per month for taking care of the little boy. That would hardly take me to the university. But I did persist, and I went to the University of Minnesota, and I did become a nurse, but I didn't change. I still was the same person, right on through, same identical things. The only thing is, I loved nursing, and I didn't walk out on that. If I hadn't have liked it so well, I'm sure that I would have started skipping, but then that would have been the end of me. And then it came time, and I graduated and became an RN, and I had a chance to go into the University of Minnesota's service to the United States. And they were going to have a group go over to Italy. And I was going to go with them. Now, by this time, my father had died. He died at age 53. And my mother was alone. And she said, you can't go. And I said, who is to stop me? So I waited and waited. And they said, be patient. And that is not the name of the game for me. Patience is not in it. I said, I can't wait any longer. And they said, we expect to go any day. You can go with us. Just give us a little time. So I enlisted in the Army. I enlisted in the Army and went to Wyoming and Cheyenne, and I fought the Battle of Cheyenne. My group went overseas, and I stayed home. So I got along fine there. I was happy there. And I was transferred to Fitzsimmons General in Denver. And I learned to love Denver. And I lived there a long time. But then I met my husband-to-be. I was with a group of women from the Army. They were mostly reservists. But there were a few regular Army. And I heard a story about a man who was a doctor who was at Carlisle Barracks in Pennsylvania on training. And they said, wait till you see him, but he's got a girlfriend. So I thought, well, he must be pretty wonderful. Well, by the time that I got a chance to see him, we had made a plan, a reservist had made a plan, because his girlfriend was a regular Army. We would take her away and get rid of her, and one of us would take him. So we really had things down just past. And we picked out a little blonde girl who was real vivacious and so forth, and we said, you do it. And so she did. She went after him, and he got sick. We won't blame her, but he got sick. And he was put in the hospital, and they said he had had a coronary. He was 25 years old. So he stayed in the hospital for a while, and I went to visit him. I thought that would be a charitable thing to do. And I liked him. He was very, very nice. He was nice looking, and he was intelligent, and he was charming. Has anybody, I suppose you've never met anybody like that. But he was like that. And so we visited for a little while, and so forth and so on. And then I had to go back down to Denver. So I thought, well, that's the end. I won't see him again. But it was nice talking with him. And then I heard that he had gone on sick leave. And so one day I was down in Denver in town, and I, lo and behold, went into a store and had a revolving door, and as I was going in, he was coming out. And he had two friends with him from Cheyenne, and he said, "Where have you been? I've been trying to get you." I said, "Oh, what do you want?" He said, "Well, I'm on sick leave, and I'm going to stay down here until I go back to duty." And I said, "Oh, well, that's great." You know, and thinking, I wonder what girlfriend he has now. But anyway, we began to see each other. And he was staying in a hotel. And one time, get this, on the 4th of July, he said, "I'm going to have a picnic in my room, and I'd like you to come." Well, I was pretty naive, but I thought, well, I better get somebody to go with me. So I had one of the other nurses come to the picnic, and she later became my maid of honor. But, you know, that brings me back to my mother, one of the things I remember about my mother. On her honeymoon, she took her best girlfriend with her on her honeymoon. I've never heard of that since, but she actually did that. So then while we were at this picnic, he said, "I found the girl I want to marry." And I said, "Oh, great, who is it?" And he said, "It's you." "Me?" I said, "I don't want to get married." Well, I did. I did want to get married. So we got married, and this lady that I told you about, this nurse, was the maid of honor. And we had, at that time, Auntie Who Drinks. That was my husband's aunt by a marriage. And she had become a complete alcoholic in about 6 months by her husband's death. They had no children, and he died, and somebody said to her, "Here, take this drink. It will help you." And her first drink, she was probably in her late 60s, and she became and was dead of alcoholism in 6 months. Now that's how fast it went. She did everything that you never would have believed a person of her caliber could do. She fell down in the little town where my husband's father was a doctor and just ruined the family, you know, with this alcoholism. But anyway, one or two people at our wedding reception were posted to keep Auntie from drinking. And we had a, what do you call those, candid shots of the wedding reception. And every picture that I have today has Auntie with the... So we didn't make it. Okay. Now I have a husband. And my husband is very, very nice, and he's very, very good to me. And he makes life very enjoyable for about 6 weeks. The first happening was we were always playing tricks on each other and really having fun, I thought. And he was in uniform, and we went down to a little convenience store. And while he was in the store, I drove around the block, and he was, being in uniform at that time, he was not supposed to carry babies or groceries in uniform. So I just, I saw him on the curb with groceries, I just passed him and went around the corner again around the block. And when I came back, his face was absolutely red and contorted. I had never seen him like that. "Don't you ever do that to me again," He's talking to the one who does everything they want to do on their own. No? So I was pretty much waiting to do it again, but I didn't tell him that. So that was the beginning. We had all the friends that we had were drinkers. They were not alcoholics, but they were heavy drinkers. And every place we went, we drank, and I included. The army, when they had any kind of a doings, they put out a table like you wouldn't believe. Help yourself. Bottle after bottle of the best liquor you could get. And so it became a way of life for me. My husband began to have, after we were married not too long a time, a lot of abdominal pain. And he was working in a cantonment type area, and he was his own boss. So he used codeine to take care of the pain. We thought it was my cooking, but it wasn't. And it turned out that he had to have his gallbladder taken out. So I thought, well, that's the end of the codeine. But it wasn't. When he came back, he was using codeine. When he came back from the hospital, they gave it to him. So that kind of thing went on for quite some time. And I began to look at his pupils, and I said, what in the world is wrong with your pupils? They're so little. And he said, that's all you ever think of. He said, there's nothing wrong with my pupils. So I look again, and they're little pinpoints, you know. Well, it was the codeine. He was taking so much of it. Now, with it, he was using alcohol. So, from there, we had to see about getting out of the army. And what he needed to do was go to Fort Sam Houston. And there he would go before the medical board and see if he was eligible for retirement, medical discharge. And so he left me. By then we were in Joplin, Missouri, and I had a baby. I had a 6-month-old child, and he left me there alone. Well, now, I'm not the kind of person that's left alone in a strange town with a baby. So in a couple of days, I took off and went to Fort Sam Houston. And I got down there and found out there's no housing for us. So what we had to do was rent a garage behind some kind of an apartment. And it was fixed up a little bit. It had a kitchen in it and a bathroom. And it had a gas heater that plugged into the wall. So we had to take turns because of the baby, because this hose would slip off and we didn't want the baby to be asphyxiated. So we took turns at night. One would sleep and one would stay up and so forth. We stayed down there about 6 weeks and they did discharge him from the service. And we went now to Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I came from. Now we're going back to my relatives. And we went up there, and my husband went into practice. He had an excellent opportunity. He went in with a surgeon who was well established in his practice, and he went in as the physician internist. And the two men were to work together, and we bought a new home. Everything was just great. And that lasted roughly about a year. He finally, one night when this doctor called him and said, I'd like you to make a house call, he said, make it yourself. And you know how that went over. So he left there, and there was a doctor in University Hospital when I was there in training that I very much disliked. And he was an OBGYN specialist. And he told my husband, you can come in with me until you can get your own office. So my husband was working for this man that I just liked so much. And he finally did get an office of his own. Now, we by this time had a son. And the son's godfather, get this and mull it over, the godfather that he picked for our son was a pharmacist. Isn't that strange? Isn't that strange? I still marvel at that. This man was so clever. So clever. So whenever he needed anything while he was in practice, come down to the store, you know, you don't have to pay for it. And so he went from codeine finally through the different drugs, and he went to dopamine, which is liquid methadone. And that was his drug of choice, with the alcohol still present, but of course not as much because his other sufficed. So he lasted 6 months, and he was very, very ill physically and mentally. And so he decided that he was going to leave the practice, and we would go away for 6 months, geographical escape, and then he would be better and everything would be all right. So we took off and went to Nebraska, where his mother lived in an apartment. And we put her out of her apartment and into a friend's apartment. And we four had her apartment. And he tried to recover. It took him roughly 5 months. We had to put the little girl in school there. And when he finished his withdrawal, he was absolutely a different person. He weighed about 129 pounds. He was all drawn and sunken. His eyes were sunken in. But he began each day to feel a little bit stronger. And the day that he could walk out of the house, he went to the nearest liquor store and bought a bottle. That was it. So finally, he got a little better and a little better, and it was time for us to go. So we decided to go to Denver. We packed up the family, and we drove to Denver, and we stayed there a little bit in a motel, and we couldn't afford that for very long, so we had to leave there. And we went up north of Denver, and we went up this road, and we came to a road that went to Fort Collins and a road that went back to Nebraska. And he said, "Which way should we go?" And I said, "Flip a coin." So we went to Fort Collins. We went to Fort Collins. We rented a little house there at the foot of the mountains. And my husband, the first night we were there after dinner, he went out the back door to take the garbage out. There were houses came this way to the end, this way, and then ours. And then in the center was this place where you could empty the garbage. And he went out there, and I heard him say, "Jack!" And he was just so elated. And the man from that house had come over here. And I went out, and he said, "This is my friend, Jack." He said, "He's a pharmacist." And Jack, by that time, was saying, "Anything you need, Doc, come to the store." He had his own store. So that helped that out. Well, the next thing we did was we went to Cheyenne for Frontier Days. Has anybody been there? That's really hot, isn't it? And we had a friend, too, a friend and his wife up there. In fact, that was his best man. We spent the day out in his convertible, driving up and down the streets, you know, and so forth, and with a bottle. And by evening, my husband, when we went back to his house, my husband went down the basement where they had a room fixed up, and he went to sleep. So we were all standing in the kitchen talking and so forth, and pretty soon he came up the stairs over to me. I was standing with my back to the sink, and wham! He let me have it. This was the first physical violence that I had experienced. So he just lost all control, and this man that we were with was a doctor, and he packed him up and took him to the hospital where they put him in a straitjacket. So the next morning when I went down there, he said, "Oh my God, whatever I did, I'm not going to ever do again." He said, "That's it. I can't use drugs or alcohol." And I said, "You sure can't." So we took off and went back to Fort Collins. And pretty soon we left there and went back to Minnesota, and he went into the state hospital system. Do you know what was happening to my ideas and plans and so forth for a good life? Now he's going in the state hospital system on salary. We were lucky he had a job, but I didn't know it at that time. And he went to one state hospital, and he drank, and so they suggested maybe he transfer to another one. And so he transferred to another one, and we had a nice home there that was on the grounds, and we could live there. My children were in school, and things were going quite well, except he was beginning to drink more and more. So the man who was head of this state hospital was a psychiatrist, and he said, I think you need to have some sessions with me. And so he saw him, and they loved each other, and they were really very fond of each other. And when he would decide that my husband needed a vacation, then they'd take a vacation, and they'd go up north, and we'd go up north. And, you know, none of this was anything that any of us really wanted to do, but we did. And one day the psychiatrist called me and said he wanted to see me. And I was with him. He said, your husband says you weigh too much. And I said, and what does my husband want me to do? Lose weight. Okay, I'll lose weight. So I went out and lost weight. And I went back to the psychiatrist and I said, well, what does he think? And he said, I asked him. He said he didn't notice. Do any of you know what I'm talking about? Of course you do. This is everybody's story, isn't it? It's just that we have a few little personal items of our own, but it's everybody's story. So, the next thing we had to do, because he couldn't stand him anymore, was we had to get out of there. So we moved then, both of us, the family, we moved to another state hospital. It was about probably 150 miles from where we were. So we went up there, and we made a home there. I want to tell you one thing. On our way up, we had two cars. So I had the dog and one child in my car, and he had another child in his, and the cat, I think. And so we stopped to eat on the way. And when we came out, we both got in our own cars. And he went that way, and I went this way. I was going back to the old home again. So he had to rush down the highway behind me and tell me, hey, you're going the wrong direction. So I went there. Well, that living in that town was a complete disaster. We had nothing but trouble. They had a program for alcoholics, and particularly for alcoholic physicians, in the hospital. And my husband would go to a meeting, and then he would invite all the other doctors to come down to the house, and they would play poker and drink. Until the superintendent of the hospital says, that's enough of that. You go to a psychiatrist. So he went into the cities and went to the VA hospital, and he had the chief of psychiatry. And the chief of psychiatry was also extremely nice to him. He treated him like a son. And he would see me periodically, and then he said, you're going to have to see somebody. He said, things aren't going too well for you. You're going to have to see somebody. So they got me a man who was in the outpatient department of the VA system, and he said after he interviewed me that he would see me in his office in town. So for 8 years, I was psychoanalyzed by him. You think I changed? I told myself much more about me than I ever told him. Much more. I laid on his couch. He was good to me. He thought I was a nice person, and I thought that was great, but he didn't get into my story. He later killed himself with alcohol. Not because of me, I'm sure. But he did. He later killed himself. So none of these things worked. When my husband would go to the psychiatrist and I would go to the psychiatrist at the same time, I would go home and my husband would go to the bar. Why do you nod? Do you have King's experience like that? She goes, mm-hmm, they do that. They do that. So, we stayed there for maybe 3 years. Our next door neighbors, he was a doctor, an OBGYN man, and they didn't like us because my husband was beginning to attempt suicide. He went into the garage one night, and I was asleep, and something woke me, and I went to the garage, and he had the motor going and the door was closed. And I turned off the motor and said, you go in the house, and he got out and went in the house. That was one of several attempts. He also took Nembutal, overdose of Nembutal, and then told me. So I stuck my finger down his throat and said, come back, Nembutal. He stopped. That's funny. He stopped working at this point. Because he was such a nice guy, they then stopped working. And he then moved upstairs in our home to my son's room. My son had the entire top floor of the house. And he had twin beds in there, and my husband moved up there. And he stayed up there, and he kept my son awake at night until I couldn't cope with it any longer. So I went to the courthouse, and I said, I would like to serve papers on this man for commitment. And they said, very well, and they told me what they would do. They said the next day they would pick him up and for everybody to be out of the house. So the next day they picked him up and they put him in jail. And I went down to the jail with his Thorazine. He was on Thorazine at that time. And I went down to the jail and said to the bailiff, will you give this to my husband? He needs it for sleep. And my husband sent the Thorazine out with word to me to take it myself. So I left there, and then we were called to the day in court. And the doctor who was there said, if your doctor and veterans would take you, would you go in to the hospital? Of course, he said. Why is anybody questioning that? Just call my doctor. So they called him. Of course he'd take his dear boy. So the dear boy went to the veterans hospital. Now, he had been there umpteen times. He had on numerous occasions in the hospital attempted suicide. He went out and got a bottle one day, he drank the entire bottle, and he went into the bed and put the pillow over his head tight. And the nurse found him. So things were getting worse and worse and worse all the time. But they kept him in the hospital again for approximately 6 weeks. And when he came home, he didn't come to our house. He went to his friend's house, who was a psychologist, alcoholic. Now that was a nice place to go, after you've spent 6 weeks in the hospital trying to get off the stuff. So I remember one time we both were called by his wife to go to this house because she couldn't get him out of the bathtub. He had passed out in the bathtub. So we went over there to haul him out of the bathtub. And so forth and so on. But I should finish that part of the story. That man divorced this wife and remarried, and the woman he remarried killed him with a shotgun. Have you ever heard such horrible stories? Yes. Yes, I know you have. I know. I've heard them too, and they weren't mine. Yeah. So he didn't come home until one night he came over to get something of his. And he said, what are you cooking? Oh, I don't know, something, whatever. He said, would you mind if I stayed for dinner? It took him about 5 days and he was back in the house. So he came back, and it was decided then that we should move again. It wasn't the right place for us. The superintendent there was a woman, and she was on his tail. She could have gotten help for him, but everybody else was good to him and just made it easy for him to go ahead. Enablers, all of them, me included. And so guess where we had to go now? Back to the first hospital. We had to go back to the first place we were in the state system. So this time, we couldn't get a house on the grounds. They were all taken, so we had to buy a house. We bought a small house. And we lived there for about a year, and my husband decided he wanted to move. So he went out looking, and he found a house for $30,000 in a beautiful location, a beautiful home, and I hated it. And he kept, you know, putting little subtle pressure on me, subtle pressure, and so forth. I said, we can't afford it, for one thing. I don't like the house. It's sort of semi-country, and so forth. And Nancy, our daughter, said to me one day, why do you oppose him so? He wants that house. And I gave in. I said, okay. Well, very shortly, I knew why he wanted that house. It had an access that was away from the family. It had four levels, actually. A basement, and then an area with a family room, a den, and a bath, and a laundry area, and a door to the outside. So he could use that area whenever he wanted to get away and just shut himself off from the family. 2 weeks he was there, and he would not come out. So one day, my plan number 999, I said, I'll fix him this time. So I went down to the liquor store, and I bought a bottle of Canadian Club, and I came in, and I put the Canadian Club on the mantle, and I took the 2 6-packs of beer I bought, and I put them in the kitchen, and I opened 4 cans, poured it down there, down the drain, opened another can, and went and sat on the 3 little stairs that were there. And I called out to him, and I said, you're not the only one this family can drink. So he put his head around the corner, and I got this beer. And I said, don't you come any closer to me, or I'll kill you. I wouldn't have killed him. He walked right past me up the little stairs, and the phone was on the wall. He called the police. He said, my wife is trying to kill me. So the police came. Now that's the closest I've been to the police, and it was rather frightening. So we sat in the living room, talked very quietly, and he said, well, he said, let me use your phone. So he went to the phone. I heard him say, well, everything's okay. They're quiet. So he said, he came back and he said, do you want to press charges? And my husband said, of course, I don't want to be killed. So he pressed charges and I went to jail. That was the most humiliating thing that has happened in my entire life. And I knew the people who were the jailers. I knew them. And to walk in there and be put behind bars for the night. One telephone call, I learned that. So I called my psychiatrist. He sent his attorney. See how all these people are helping us? Nobody ever said, why don't you stand on your own 2 feet? Nobody ever said that. So the attorney came down in the morning, and he got me out on my own reconnaissance. And I said, what's reconnaissance? He said, I know you. And they let me go home. My husband would not speak to the attorney. He was home. I cried from the time I got home, like, say, 10 o'clock until 6 o'clock that night. Solid. And I'm not a crier. And at 6 o'clock, he said, I think that's enough. I think you've learned your lesson. Let's go out for dinner. Who said no? So I said, I'll go for dinner with you if you promise not to drink. Promise number 777. We sat down, the waitress came over, and he said, bring me a bottle of wine. I said, I thought you weren't going to drink. Just wine. Oh, just wine. So he drank. Okay. In AA, he went to AA, and he helped people very, very much. He had a knack for helping people, and he did a great job. He had one man, a young man, who was just about dead. He had continuous convulsions and so forth, and he helped him. And this man became his friend. And he encouraged my husband to go to AA, and he went, but he only went to help people. He went there without drinking, but when he came home, he took the bottle off the shelf and he got soused. So I eventually began to believe that AA was a place where you went and then you came home and drank. I didn't see any other thing that it could be. So there was a couple in AA, and I later found out this woman was in Al-Anon, and they kind of latched on to us. He to him and she to me. And she said, "You have to go to Al-Anon." I said, "And what in the world is Al-Anon?" I had been going to some of the AA meetings, but gathering with the women and going into the back until the men were finished, and then coming out and getting their coffee and sandwiches or whatever. That was our Al-Anon. And she said, "I would like to take you." And I said, "Well, I wouldn't like to go." I said, "Everything is okay right now." So she finally talked me into going. And I went down to this meeting, and I watched these people, and I thought, what's wrong with them? They certainly act peculiar, and they talk about all this stuff, you know, and I don't see any reason for me to be here. And so I told him the next time that I wouldn't go. And so she came to the house, and she said, "You are going." So I went like 6 times. I went, and I heard nothing. I had no idea what they were talking about to this day, except if I go back in my mind and program, I know what they're talking about. But anyway, this was in January of 1965, and in July the 7th of 1965, my husband committed suicide. He actually killed himself with cyanide. You think he wasn't serious? He was plenty serious. Now, what's left for me? These two people, they immediately, when they heard about it, and his friend from me, came into the house and stayed with me. I was in a state of shock for days, but they were right there. Whenever there was a meeting of Al-Anon, she had me. She had me. So I began to go, I began to hear some of the things. I began to go around to the Twin Cities and listen. And I heard some things, but they still didn't have a great deal of meaning. I didn't see how I could apply it in my own life. Then one of my friends in Al-Anon came to me and said, "You're going to have to work, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'll go with you. Let's go get a job." So we went up to Twin Cities. We were only about 35 miles from the Twin Cities. And we went up there and we got a job in psychiatry. Now that's just where I needed to be. So we worked there for like 6 months. And she said one day, all excited, she said, "Have you ever heard of Hazelden?" "No," I said, "what's Hazelden?" "It's a treatment center out in Center City, and they need nurses." And I said, "If you want to go, you go. I don't want to see an alcoholic again in my life." So she persisted, and she came one day and she said, "I have a letter. The psychologist out there wants to interview us." I said, "Me? How does he know about me?" She said, "Oh, I told him." So I said, "Well, I'll drive out with you, but I want nothing to do with it." So we drove out to Center City, and she was interviewed, and he asked me to come down. He asked me, so I went down, and he interviewed me. And then came a letter and said, "We'd like you both to come to work April of 1966. This is when they were going to have women out there. They were going to close a place further in toward the town and bring the women out there and build a new complex. And they wanted me to come and work there. And I said, "Well, I'm not going." So on the appropriate day, we went out there, and I went to work. And she stayed. Now, this is the absolute truth. She stayed 1 month. Her husband, who was an alcoholic, did not want his wife working in alcoholism. He was afraid she might be corrupt in some way. So she went back to the hospital and left me there. And I waited for weeks and months for her to come back. I waited 16 years. She never returned. And I stayed there. And it was great. It was absolutely great. Every pore in my body has goosebumps on it right now, just thinking about how great it was. It was absolute perfection. They asked me in 1972, they said, would you work in the family program? Listen to this now, 66 to 72. Going to Al-Anon, active. I said, no way. Look at me. If I can recover, so can they, on their own. Isn't that beautiful? How stupid can you get? How stupid can you get? So anyway, they said, well, this is all well and good, but we want you to work in the family program. So I went to the family program because I wanted to work at this place. And gradually, I began to change. Not a great deal, but enough so I knew it in my own head. Things are not quite as drastic with you, I said to me. I still lived in this town that was quite a ways away, so I commuted. But I could arrange my schedule, so I had two nights out there and two nights at home. And as soon as I got home, my sponsor was there, right on the doorstep. Tell us everything. They didn't need to say, you know, do this, do that, do this. Just talk to us. And for months, I talked to them. And they are such beautiful people. And they understood me, and they cared about me, and they helped me, and I began to recover. This is a long time, isn't it? But I began to recover. Not fully, not today fully, but recovering to the point where I could do lots of good things to help alcoholics. One day a man came into treatment and I interviewed him. And he, after he was so sick, and he turned to me and he said, how long have you been here? I said, 8 years. Oh my God, he said, is it going to take me that long? So many things happened, so many things that were beautiful. Even right down to this trip to visit with you, it's just been a superb life. And Bill called me and asked me if I would come here. Of course I would come here. I would go any place that I could be with Al-Anon AA people. Any place. It's the only way that I knew to get myself back together. So I'm still a widow. Is anybody eligible? I have a little 17-year-old poodle. And I use the program every day with her. But I love her so thoroughly that I will do anything I need to do. And I don't know if I have much more to say to you. I hope I've imparted to you how deeply I feel on this subject. Well, that's it. Do you have any questions, any comments, any whatever that you want to talk about? You're all okay. Am I okay as far as time? Okay, then thank you very much. I appreciate it.